Welcome to another episode of the Can't Deposit Excuses podcast. I'm your host, Derek Wiley. And before we get started, you can find our podcast on all the major platforms. Feel free to look us up on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon. We are anywhere you'd want to find us. Also, if you're watching us on YouTube, I wouldn't be a YouTuber if I didn't say please smash the like button and subscribe to our channel. You can catch our latest episodes. With that being said, I want to go in and get into today's topic, which is something that's very interesting. I heard about this book for a while and been, you know, seeing it in different places over the years. But I'd never read it, never taken the time to actually go through and read it. And so I finally got an opportunity to read this book. And I think it has a lot of potential to kind of explain where we are currently in terms of the country, the tenor, the feeling that we all feel. But also, if you're in business, this kind of explains the buying patterns, the behaviors of different groups. The book that I'm talking about is called The Fourth Turning. This is a book that was written by William Strauss and Neil Howe. The book came out in 1997. It wasn't really paid that close of attention to at the time, because I don't think we were in the right headspace as a country or as a society to notice it. But what is it about? It's about the idea that society is grouped into these long lifespans that they call, trying to think of the term that we would use to describe this, but I'm just going to say 80 to 90 year periods of time that are the long lifespan of a human life. And in those long lifespans of a human life, there are going to be four archetypes, four different generations that come of age. And this cyclical nature kind of explains how there are ebbs and flows. Perfect example. Have you ever heard of the term or the phraseology, good times breed weak men. Weak men bring bad times. Bad times breed strong men. That's essentially the idea. And so these two gentlemen, they were historians, and they were studying generational trends. And they got together and wrote a book based on their research. And a lot of times people have said it's pseudoscience, it's not real. The data to back it up may not be there. There's a lot of anecdotal stories, and a lot of that may be true. But it is interesting, we are now 24 years post this book coming out, and a lot of the things that they stated would happen have started to happen, which is where they get the term the fourth turning. It's the idea that we're going to see a massive upheaval in society sometime between now and 2025. And I feel like as a adult in society today, I cannot think of a time in which I felt more unsure of what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, next year.
What he means is Old Testament, Mr. Yes. Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Enough, I get the point.
There is a tenor in the air and uncertainty that we all feel, that we're like, you know, things just don't feel right, be it the political climate, be it the situation we have currently going on with the pandemic, whether it be just the all out vitriol that you see online from different people in different political classes, parties, class warfare, strife, civil unrest. It just feels like we're in a weird time. So this book is trying to explain maybe what we're going through. So here's kind of the idea. Every major event in American history goes along this cyclical nature. So it starts with the American Revolution up through the Civil War. Then we have the Great Depression, World War I, World War II, that period of time. And now we're in this latest period. And if you go back and do the timing on this, it tends to go in 80 to 100 year time spans that this occurs. And so we think of history when we learn it as linear, it moves in a straight line. But if you really look at it, as Mark Twain coined the phrase, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And so that's generally the idea here. So in the book, they lay out that there are basically four generations that we currently have. Now, this was written in 1997. These guys don't get it all right. I think there's definitely some criticism that could be levied against some of the ideas, and there's obviously some things that didn't pan out exactly the way they thought they would. But here are the general ideas. You have the baby boomer generation. That is the generation that's currently in power. They were born and came into existence during the end of the last crisis period. That would have been World War II. And so they come of age, baby boomer generation, born 1943 to 1960. And that's our current oldest generation for the most part. So that would be the generation that currently has power. And then after that generation, we would have had kind of the generation X / silent generation. There is a generation before that that's born, say, in the years in between, but the generation X is basically 1961 to 1981. That generation is starting to also replace some of the baby boomers. They're starting to come to power. When this book was written in 1997, I think of Generation X, I think of Friends or Seinfeld. Like, that was the people that were, you know, young adults were made up that generation. Then after that, you have the millennials, which were born 82 to 2004, depending upon different people that you look at, different sets of data. They may have that a little bit skewed, but essentially that's the millennial generation. And then I'm going to change, because they stop at the millennial generation in the book, but I'm going to make the argument that you now have, there's been some debate about how to phrase it, but Generation Z, the Zoomers. I've also seen Generation Alpha, but we'll just say 2005 and onward. But in the book, they really talk about the silent generation that we talk about, which is, I actually talk about the GI generation, which was my grandparents. This was the people that fought World War II, was the GI generation. So what happens is, after World War II, we have a group of people that come to power, which were the GIs, that had just went and fought, you know, one of the most devastating wars in human history. They come back and they set up society in their image. And if you think about the post-World War II era, think about the Leave It to Beaver. These are just the images that I get in my head. Leave It to Beaver, that was the television. Everybody, you know, minded their P's and Q's. Babies were being born. Suburbia, sprawl was starting to take effect. That is the post-crisis era. So the crisis, World War II is over. This turns into the awakening. So in the book, they talk about in every series of a human life, you're going to go through these seasons. These seasons are going to be winter, right? Spring, autumn, fall, and then another winter. So World War II would have been winter. So the 1950s, 1960s, that's the awakening. That's the springtime. And so think about that time frame. What was it like? Well, we had you know, all of these people that were coming of age, Woodstock, right? Free love. The Vietnam War was occurring. You know, but for the most part, things were springing to life. Things were changing. That was the awakening. That was this period. In the book, they argue that during this period of time, you basically have the boomer generation. Those are who, you know, it's hard to believe that, you know, the people that are currently in power, like a Joe Biden, who's currently president, you know, he is of that generation. This was the Woodstock generation. That's who these people were. They were that generation that came of age. And they pushed back against the systems that existed post-World War II. They pushed back against, you know, the Leave It to Beaver society. They pushed, instead of institutions, they pushed individualism, right, and having choices and not being part of a system. And that this is common throughout history, that this happens next after a major crisis. Well, what happens after that? Well, then another round of children are born, right, which is going to be that Generation X that in the book they call it the 13ers. They come of age to parents and in a society that doesn't really value children. Think about if you were in this demographic, latchkey kids, you know, you come home, you get off the bus, there's no one there, mom and dad aren't there, they're not as around, not as available. We don't cherish children as much during this time frame. It's more about the individual liberty of adults and young adults and people doing their own thing. Children, you know, they exist obviously on the periphery, but society doesn't really value children all that much during this period of time. And they have to keep in mind this generational idea. It's across the board. It doesn't mean that your experience had to be like this as a child. It's just saying, by and large, this is the way society functioned. And so it made for what they call the nomad generation. These children that were born during this time frame, these Generation X groups, you know, they were very much a group that is self-sufficient. They're pragmatic. In the way that they operate, they have to be pragmatic in the way that they operate because, you know, they weren't coddled, shall we say. Then we get to the current generation, which are the millennials. And in the book, they are the last generation. The book written in 1997, the first millennials would graduate high school in the year 2000. So this would have been essentially the freshman year of high school for most millennials when the book came out. So they have a lot of predictions of how they think the millennials will operate. They argue that millennials often are going to copy and be very similar to their mirror generation, which for a millennial, the mirror generation for them would have been the GIs, right? The post-World War II generation, the greatest generation. And so they think they're going to be very much institutional, they're rule followers. They make predictions about the type of music that they'll like. And I think, you know, in some degree, they got a lot of that right. You have to think what was going on during the early 1990s. Power Rangers, Barney, these types of things were all the rage. And so it's almost as if the Generation X had a little bit of an edge to it, but the millennial generation was very coddled. The things changed. The people looked and said, oh, we've got to protect this generation. We've got to make sure that, you know, we have good things for this generation. Think about Tipper Gore during this time frame. If you remember the parental advisory being placed on music and on records, these are the types of things that were happening in society during this time. And so that's the generation that came. All these generations have an archetype. And I can best describe it as Star Wars. So think about Star Wars. So they would call the baby boomer generation the prophets. That is going to be, obviously, if you've ever watched Star Wars. And if you haven't, then this analogy may not make sense. But I'm sure you'll pick up on an example that may work. But you've got this little guy named Yoda. He would be your prophet generation. Right. And then who is Luke Skywalker? Luke Skywalker is going to be your hero generation. That's what they call the millennials, the hero. Right. And who's that silent generation, that generation that's kind of between or nomad generation that's in there? Maybe that is your Han Solo. Right. Maybe that is, you know, who fits into that mold. And so everybody has a role to play in this story, in this cyclical period of time. So what they believe will happen is that just like in the seasons of life, winter, spring, fall, and then winter, the human life experience works the same way. In every 20 to 25 years, as the next group moves into the next phase of life, so too does society shift and change. So we started off very institutional, very by the book, 1950s, right, post-World War II, move into this awakening period during the time of the 1960s, early 1970s. Then we move into this period from, let's say, the mid-1980s, maybe 1984 to the late 1990s. This period they call the Unraveling. The Unraveling is basically the period in time in which there's immense pressure on the systems. There's a lot of pushback about society, different groups. I think of the 1990s. I think Bill Maher had a great show, Politically Incorrect, if you remember that from the 1990s. He's still on HBO, obviously, but he had a show back then, Politically Incorrect, and it was the culture wars, right? They still exist today. We still are living with the culture wars. We call it, they call it wokeism, PC culture, but that was that period of time. And so during this unraveling period, people start to question, you know, these systems that we have operating. Things don't seem to be working out the way that they had always worked out for previous generations. And so what then happens after that is you have the fourth turning, the crisis period. And they predicted the crisis period would last from 2005, roughly. They thought it would begin around 2005, and then it would end in about 2025, right? 20 to 25 year periods of time. I think they're off a little bit. I think when 9/11 happened, many of us thought that that would be the crisis of a generation. It would be a generational crisis. Turns out that it wasn't the generational crisis. I think it was a crisis, obviously, and we fought a war on terror. And amazingly in the book, and this is something where it's almost scary, but they had three predictions of what could lead to the crisis, what could be the crisis. One of those was war with a foreign power, could break out, could be a war with a superpower, could be a war fought, you know, anywhere in the world, but it would be a significant war. I don't really think we got that with the second Gulf War with Iraq, with Afghanistan. We got a long-term war, but we didn't get a major war. The other things they throw out is that there could be a constitutional crisis. There could be a crisis where maybe there's an argument about the debt ceiling not being raised, and maybe the they say mayors have arguments with the federal government, and there's a crisis between maybe Congress and the president about what's constitutional and what their powers are and what they can lead to, and that results in a constitutional crisis. We're currently in the midst of a debt ceiling conversation here in fall of 2021. So that's an example, although I don't think it's going to lead to the major issue, the major crisis, but that's something that they bring up. Another example they give of what could set off the crisis is they say the CDC could come along and they could announce, hey, listen, we've got a spread of a new communicable disease, and that Congress could mandate mandatory quarantine measures.
Great Scott.
And that mayors could resist that, and there could be a war between urban gangs and suburban militias. And there could be calls for martial law. Now, these guys didn't have a crystal ball, but they're students of history. I was a student of history, and they saw these patterns, and these were examples of things they thought could potentially happen. No one knew what could happen. But it feels like a lot of the things that they talked about as possibilities are actually coming true. They're happening.
It's really happening.
Now, which one will be the primary catalyst, that remains to be seen. But obviously, there's a lot of different things that are occurring that all tie back into this. So why is this important? Well, it's important because we have to plan for what the future may hold. And people have asked the authors, you know, is there anything that we can do to stop the fourth turning from occurring, this last end period? And their answer is no. There's nothing we can do to stop it. This is unfortunately the arc of human history, that it makes this circle, and it's required. In many ways, you can think about it how a forest has to have a forest fire to clear the underbrush in order for a new society, a new system to arise out of the ashes. You have to have these periods of time. And so we're in the period of time where the current system that we've all been living under, become accustomed to, is likely to be thrown out for something new. A different system will rise in its place. What does that mean? I don't know what it means, and neither do the authors. They don't really give an example as to what that may look like. It could be great for America. It could be fantastic. It could lead to another awakening, right? Another high. They call that period the high right after the crisis. You have the high period. And that's that Leave It to Beaver time between then and the next awakening. But we could have that, or we could, as many societies over the course of human history have found, they have fallen. There's no guarantee that, you know, our society and our place in the world remains where it is. The British Empire has fallen. The Roman Empire has fallen. The American Empire could just as easily go away. It all depends upon how these different actors play their roles in the foreseeable future. In the book, they believe the millennial generation, the hero generation, will be the generation that will essentially take the place of the last hero generation, which were the GIs of World War II, that they will be the ones to push back against the system and kind of set it on its head. Generally, what happens is there is a battle that takes place between the outgoing generation of power, which are the baby boomers, and the millennials. And that's what sets up that relationship comes to a head. And so the millennials take power from that last generation that had it, and society starts anew. In looking at society and the way things are currently structured, I think that, you know, the millennial generation was thought to be going to be in young adulthood when this happened, and some of them still are. But the real crisis, I don't believe, happened in 2001, obviously, and it didn't happen in 2005. I believe the beginning of this turning is the financial crisis of 2009. That is your beginning of your fourth turning. The financial crisis has all the hallmarks. It's a major event. It marked the lives, the early adult lives of millennials as they were coming of age, graduating college. The first group, the first wave, were in their mid-20s. They saw massive amounts of unemployment. They saw a system in which it was rigged to have those in power, those that ran the banks, those that had assets, were able to basically come away from that unscathed while taking advantage of plenty of other groups, and the average person was left holding the bag. And for older millennials, that made someone like myself, it meant maybe it's hard to find a job, or you can't sell your house because you're underwater on it, your first house. And for younger millennials, they watched their parents lose their homes. They watched, you know, their grandparents and their parents' retirement savings wiped out during that period. That, to me, was the period of time that led to the crisis. And if you think about the last crisis that we had, which would have been World War II, the end of World War II, what began that crisis? Well, we had World War I, right right pre-1920. What did that lead to? It led to this time period where we had a lot of the flappers, the 1920s, the roaring 1920s. We had a period of time after that where we, you know, we had in America at least some growth, some high, but it wasn't the real high, because what happens shortly thereafter, the stock market crash of 1929 occurs, and then that combination of the stock market crash plus the fallout from World War I led to the rise of Hitler. It led to the rise of fascism. It led to the rise, honestly, the Bolshevik Revolution that happened in Russia that overthrew the Tsar, and they come to power. And now you have communism, fascism, authoritarianism is taking place throughout the world. Mussolini, Stalin, Hitler, all these groups are rising up. A lot of the reason Hitler came to power was because the German people were disaffected and felt disenfranchised with the Treaty of Versailles and the way that the World War I came to an end. They weren't obviously too thrilled by it. Their country was destroyed. Their currency was devalued. And this laid the groundwork that led to World War II, in much the same way that a lot of the social, a lot of the racial, a lot of the economic strife that we've seen over the last, say, you know, 15 to 20 years, the primary thing that maybe started that process going was the financial crisis. I think it just brought things into relief. And of course, you know, after World War One, this powerful leader in Germany convinced society that a certain religious sect was responsible for all of their ills, all of the bad things that had happened were as a result of them. And I feel in much the same way, society is currently pulling itself apart, tearing itself apart, trying to find, like, why is everything, you know, unraveling? Why is it not working out the way that I thought it would work? There has to be someone to blame. So that's generally what happens is the stage, the final act, just like I described that period, that 20 to 25 year period, it culminated with World War II. So we're currently, based on their time horizon, we're in the last 5 to 10 years, 2021 to 2025, maybe 2030, because if you think that the financial crisis was the beginning, well, it happened a few years later than they thought, and what they, you know, thought may happen. So maybe in 2009, we go 20 to 25 years post-2009. It's going to take us into the mid-2020s or 2030s before we see the end of this. So what happens during the first stage? Like I said, the spark ignites. Maybe this pandemic is the thing that is the spark that leads this off. Because they talk about stage one, that's what could happen. And like I said, I mean, this was written, think about this, 24 years ago. They say the CDC will announce the spread of new communicable viruses, that Congress will have to enact mandatory quarantine measures. Mayors may resist. In this case, I think it's governors. We look at governors that have resisted some of the federal mandates, and that urban gangs of suburban militias could come to power and fight small battles, and there could be calls for martial law. Stage two is called the disruption. The disruption is a time in which we're going to see a new mood. We're going to see jarring new problems that will provide a natural endpoint for the unraveling. Things will be in decline. Civic confidence and crisis will catalyze. There will be a focus on the jagged and exposed distrust that we all have towards institutions. So I feel like we're seeing that right now. People are distrustful of government. They're distrustful of their schools. They're distrustful of the health authorities. They're distrustful of, multiple institutions. There just has never been a time in my lifetime that I can think that there's more distrust out there for institutions, and people just don't have faith in them. People are going to feel that their survival is going to require them to distrust these things. So it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more this goes on, the more this distrust is sown, the more people will feel like their survival is dependent upon distrust in these institutions. And so that behavior could cascade into a downward spiral. And so that's the second phase, that breakdown in trust. So the stage three is collapse. And we obviously aren't in that stage yet. I don't know, but based on the timeline, I feel like that's potentially in the next 12 to 24 months that you would potentially see a collapse. What could that collapse look like? What does that collapse mean? Well, when we're talking about collapse, we're talking about at some point this short-term crisis that we're all experiencing is going to come to a head. We're going to see an end point. The psychology of the people is going to catch up to the reality on the ground. We can see a Great Depression. We could see a drop in the market price of assets. Right now, we're seeing the profits on Wall Street are at all-time highs. The S&P 500 has been moving up steadily here in the last few weeks. It's pulled back, but by and large, asset prices are at a high we've never seen before. We've got things we've seen this year, lumber at all-time highs, property values at all-time highs, used cars at all-time highs. Inflation is running rampant. There are supply chain shortages throughout the economy. We cannot get the raw materials needed to make goods for the world. And then the goods that we do have are sitting off the shore of California and these other major ports because we don't have the people to move the goods. We have a shortage of workers. People have elected to leave the workforce. And I think there is a current thing going on between labor and between employers. Employers are going to have to pay more money in order to attract and retain talented people. People are not going to continue to put up with the low wages. They're not going to continue to put up with the lack of benefits that they had in the past. And they've decided it's better for me to stay home or to work in a gig economy, right? We have a gig economy. People have Uber and Lyft, and people have photography businesses on the side. People have party planning and wedding planning businesses on the side, floral businesses on the side, selling jewelry, selling makeup, selling fitness programs. There's plenty of side hustles. So people are trying to find other ways. They're not going through the traditional W-2, I'm going to work for this employer. People are taking it upon themselves to cut their own path. So we are seeing that. But generally in history, if you look at it, we go from a period of inflation, which is what we're kind of seeing now, that could lead to then hyperinflation or deflation. And so we could see the values of assets either skyrocket or drop like a rock, and this could be the collapse. In that case, trust further disintegrates. It's almost like, and they describe it in the book as this, it's like a magnet is run over the hard disk drive of society. So all the promises that were made are erased. What are some promises that we have in society that were given to us, in American society at least, that we think are going to be there? Social Security, right? That's a social contract. The new deal, FDR, a lot of these social programs. There could come a point where we as a society realize we can no longer afford to have these programs. The value that we place on Medicare, the value that we place on Social Security, these things that are supposed to be there for our elderly, we could see a situation where we say to those generations, those things that were promised to you are not going to be able to be delivered upon because the people that are now coming up can't have all of that debt and all of that requirement to take care of you into the future on our backs. So we're going to break that contract. We're going to break that promise. So that is one thing. You could see 401ks become nationalized, or they tell you that they're going to have your 401k and you get all this money and it's tax-free and you don't pay any taxes to your 59 and a half. That could change. They could come out and say, well, listen, we're going to have to change the system because we're in a tremendous amount of debt. We've got crises all around us. We've got to figure out a way out of it. One of the things we're going to do is we're going to make either your 401ks accessible. Maybe people pull money out of them and there's no penalty, or they just say the taxes on those are going to go up tremendously and the value proposition is not going to be there for them. We don't know exactly how this will play out. But during this period of collapse, the promises are going to be cleared. The books are going to be cleared. All the things that we think are going to be there for us, or we've thought were going to be there for us, they're going to be wiped away. And then stage four is the climax, right? So this is what happens after the collapse. There's going to be a battle. We don't know what kind of battle it's going to be, but it's going to be some type of battle. It could be an actual war. One thing that's scary is that anytime there has been this crisis period, when it happens, wars are fought till total domination, total victory. If you think about the last 20 to 30 years, honestly, the last 50 years since World War II, the United States has not won a war. The Korean War, stalemate. The Vietnam War, left it. Saigon fell. We just saw what happened in Afghanistan. We were there for 20 years. We left. They took the country. There isn't the intestinal fortitude. There isn't the desire to stay and have total victory, because total victory requires there to be very little attention paid to the consequences. And we know, like, you can win the wars in these places. We could have won all these wars, but what would it have required? It would require us to use all the technology we have at our disposal, all the warfighting technology. And the last time the world was willing to use that technology was World War II, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bombs dropped on Japan. That was the last time the world was willing to launch all-out warfare that was going to result in total victory for one side or the other. And in the history of these periods of time of, you know, the high, the awakening, the unraveling, and the crisis, if it does end in war, always ends in the societies that battle it launching all-out warfare till the end, till there is absolute victory. There is none of this, moral victories or strategic victories. it is a total and all-out victory. And in all these cases, the societies have used the most advanced technological warfare and weapons that they had at their disposal to win the war. And so that's something that's scary. We look right now and we see a rising China that is looking more and more like they may be our adversary. There is the threat of an invasion of Taiwan. America's never looked more weaker, more divided than it does right now. So if that ends up being the actual final climax as a war with China, this feels like that is on the table, and that's a possibility. Then again, it could be internal war. There's a lot of conversation about civil war. Could that happen in America? Could we see that? Obviously, there's possible constitutional crises that could arise. Could a state decide that it no longer wants to be a part of the United States, and a secession movement could occur as a result? It's absolutely possible. They don't say in the book that, like I said, it's looking at trends in history. There's no guarantee as to how this ends. There's just a guarantee that there will come a time in which society changes, the old system is thrown out, a new system rises. And generally when that happens, this climax can involve, it can involve public and private militias. You could have companies that have their own private militias, the Pinkertons. If you do any history, you'll know about how they were breaking up labor unions in the 1920s and 30s. And so you could have things like that. This, the event that happens will be so vast and unimaginable that it'll be beyond anything that we can comprehend. So, you know, we really don't know how this will end. Could it be a class war? Rich and poor. I feel like that's something that's been going on. Think about the Occupy Wall Street movement once again, post the financial crisis. Could it be superpower war with China and the United States? Could it be a war on terrorism? I think that's less likely. I think that was a possibility, but we've just gone through that, and I just don't see that rising to that level. But maybe with a rising Afghanistan, or if we've pulled out of those areas, maybe a new caliphate comes to power in the Middle East or in those areas. And so maybe that is a possibility. I don't really know. But what can we take from this? You know, what does this mean for those of us here? What it means is we've got to prepare and be aware that there is in the air a likely change that's going to occur. And in the world of business, all of these different groups, they all operate differently. They all think differently. And people all often say, well, why did these guys arrive at this idea that this is how society moves? And the reason is that the people that are raised during a certain time all have a similar lived experience. And so throughout human history, this similar lived experience has lent one generation to act a certain way, and then to raise children that acted in a certain way. And then those children would raise another generation that would act in a certain way. And as you can see, this cycle can repeat itself over and over again, just because it's based upon the time in which you came into adulthood, and then came into maybe your midlife, and then into your older life. Let me ask you this question. Would the response to, and they bring this up, would the response to Richard Nixon and Watergate, would that response be similar in 1930s America as it was in 1970s America? How do you think society would have reacted to a couple of upstart journalists, Woodward and Bernstein, attacking and bringing down a very popular president at the time? Would they have reacted the same way they did in the 1970s? What about the way we reacted as a society to Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1941? We had something similar occur with 9/11. Did we react the same way? Yeah, we went to war, but with Japan, we launched all-out war to the end. We dropped atomic weapons. Did we do that in the wars in Afghanistan and in the Middle East post 9/11? We didn't. The argument is a lot of the reasons and the decisions and the things that are done are based upon the people that are in power at that time and what their lived experience has been. And so we all play a role in this story. The thing it gets a lot of pushback is it's very deterministic. It's almost as if like everything is preordained and therefore we can't do anything to change it. And while there is going to be a crisis. It doesn't have to be an all-out war. It doesn't have to be an all-out civil war. It doesn't have to be an all-out class war. That doesn't have to happen. It is possible that the crisis is quickly averted, that it lasts a short period of time, that society quickly moves on from it. Like I said, if we look throughout the history of America, from the American Revolution to the Civil War to World War II to our current time period, there's multiple different ways that this could play out. But I think now would be a time that you would have to plan for the next 12 to 36 months, at least in the short term, potentially as far out as 5 years, and think strongly about, how you structure your life, how you plan to move forward. Be aware that this is a possibility and just look for the tea leaves, because they've kind of been laid out for you. Howe and Strauss make a very powerful argument. And while the book was panned by a lot of historians at the time as pseudoscience and not based in reality, and while you still could make that argument even today, I think the more and more that we see these things happening, it's harder to argue that they weren't onto something, that they didn't have a really, really good finger on the pulse of society and where the country is headed and where the world is headed. The other thing that they make a point of in the book is that World War II was so massive that the demographics that they describe, where you have the baby boomer, the Generation X, the millennial, where you have the nomad, the hero, the prophet, it's the same way all over the world, because the world was so devastated after World War II that, and where in the past societies, weren't so intertwined, that perhaps the whole world has similar futures ahead in multiple countries, could see similar battles take place and fights break out amongst the outgoing powerful and the incoming powerful. Look at the rise of one of our latest episodes, cryptocurrency, the idea of a decentralized currency that's outside of the bounds and borders of the traditional markets and traditional governments and fiat currency system. Is that maybe born out of that same feeling, that feeling that, hey, the old system isn't working out for the younger generation? They're not benefiting from it. The older and the wealthier are getting wealthier and getting stronger and getting more powerful, and the younger generations are being left out of that. They're not getting that opportunity. In the 1950s, families were budding. You had somebody that worked, somebody that stayed home, that watched the kids. That's how society was structured. Today, there's not enough time. You can't have a family with only one parent working. Both parents are required to work, maybe multiple jobs, 2-3 jobs to make ends meet, to get kids to school. Families are having to live together, multi-generational households. It's really only since post-World War II that we really had this secular family structure where it was condensed to a mom, a dad, maybe in society today, having a couple of kids. In the future, maybe it's not going to be structured that way. Family structures may look completely different. It may be a similar structure to the way it was in the late 19th century, where we had multiple generations living together and raising families. I think the millennial generation, you see a lot of that with those that have children. Their grandparents are much more involved. They definitely don't have the angst that Generation X had with the boomers that existed with millennials and their parents. They seem to get along a little bit better. So these are all things to be aware of. And in business, if you have a business or if you deal with people, you'll know that there are differences in the way that you approach all these groups. I guess the last thing that I would say when it comes to this idea is that there is hope that in a crisis, the next generation that comes up is the artist generation. And these artists are going to be the people that maybe help define and make society going forward. I think about when I was a kid, I'm a millennial. Growing up, we wanted to be football players and basketball players and movie stars. And what do kids today want to grow up and be? YouTubers and Twitch streamers. And it's just a different way of looking at the world. And they've got lots of ideas, and maybe they're the ones that remake the world after this crisis period ends. And that will remain to be seen. But I would encourage you guys that are listening to the podcast to go and check out the book, The Fourth Turning, An American Prophecy, and see for yourself what your thoughts are on it. The audio version of the book is also available. It's about 6 hours, I think, the audio version. And then just go and do some research. There's a Wikipedia page that you can look up and just kind of get a synopsis of what their thoughts were and how they believe that this next period of time may progress. And we're all going to be here to see how this thing comes out on the other side. I'm hopeful that we come out on the other side of this, a stronger country, in a better position to face a new world. But I also am aware that we have a lot of hurdles and a lot of challenges ahead, and that in the short term, there's going to be some tumult. There's going to be some period of time where things are going to be a little touch and go. They're going to be dicey. And that's unfortunately the way that it has to be. In order for society to progress, there's going to have to be some systems that are going to have to be upended, to be changed. And they could be for the good, they could be for the bad. And we'll all find out together. But I encourage you guys to check that out. With that being said, I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast. I appreciate you allowing me to share this information with you. Once again, please like and subscribe to the channel if you're watching us on YouTube. If you're listening to us on your favorite podcast platform, please leave us a star rating. We look forward to having you back on the next episode. So once again, have a great one, guys. See you next time.